Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in the listen-only mode. Later, we'll conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you, Janitha, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect workshop update on the treatment of liver cancer. And this is such an important topic, and we're really delighted to be able to offer this workshop to all of you. There's lots of information that you're going to learn today. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And because of that collaboration and all of your interest in the program today, we have over 450 participants on the program today. And you come from all over the United States, from all different regions of the United States, and we also have international participants from Canada, India, Indonesia, Jordan, Venezuela, and the United Kingdom. So you really come from all over the world. And it's really a credit to you that you're choosing to spend the next hour with us. Now, today's program is made possible by a charitable contribution from Bristol-Myers Squibb, and I really want to thank them for their support. I'd like to turn your attention for a moment to all the materials you received from Cancer Care. In those materials, there's an outline that has been provided by speakers in terms of the topics that will be covered, and there also is information about all the different collaborating organizations as a resource for each of you. Now, there is also an evaluation form, and I would ask you to take a moment at the end of the program today and complete that evaluation form. We really very much depend upon your feedback, your recommendations. You're our best consultants, and you tell us what you'd like us to offer, and we'll try very hard to implement it. We are in the year 2012, and we're planning many programs, and we have many more to plan for this year. So tell us what you'd like to do, what you'd like us to offer, and we'll try very hard to implement that. Now, we have wonderful speakers today, and I want to start by introducing our first speaker. It's Dr. David Ryan. Dr. Ryan is Clinical Director, Massachusetts General Hospital Cancer Center, Associate Chief Hematology Oncology, Department of Medicine. He's also Director, Tucker Gosnell Center for Gastrointestinal Cancers, and Associate Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School. And Dr. Ryan is going to address an overview of liver cancer, current standard of care, new treatment approaches, and communicating with your healthcare team. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Ryan.
Thanks, Carolyn, for having me. So first, when we talk about liver cancer, I want to explain what people are often asking about when they ask questions regarding liver cancer. When we refer to liver cancer, by convention, we're typically referring to an entity called hepatocellular carcinoma, or HCC. But there are three types of cancer that we see in the liver, and patients often get confused about which type that they have. So the most common type of cancer we see in the liver is actually a cancer that started someplace else and went to the liver, like colon cancer metastasized to the liver or breast cancer metastasized to the liver. And that is treated according to the standard principles that we typically apply to that particular treatment, that particular type of cancer, so breast cancer treatment or colon cancer treatment or lung cancer treatment. The second type of cancer that arises in the liver, which you'll hear a little bit about later on in the program, is coming from the cells that line the bile ducts of the liver. When those cells become cancerous, they create something called a bile duct cancer or a biliary tract cancer, or sometimes there's a fancy term called cholangiocarcinoma. But today, I'm going to focus on the kind of cancer that arises from hepatocytes, the main cells in the liver. When hepatocytes become cancerous, they form a cancer called primary liver cancer or hepatocellular carcinoma. We often refer to this as HCC, hepatocellular carcinoma, HCC for short. Now, hepatocellular carcinoma typically arises from hepatocytes that have been chronically stressed from damaging either agents or damaging viruses. So hepatitis B virus, hepatitis C virus, chronic alcohol injury. Sometimes people are born with metabolism errors that lead to chronic inflammation of the liver. These are the things that lead to cirrhosis and to hepatocellular carcinoma. So whenever we meet somebody with HCC, The first thing we, of course, ask is, can we cure this patient? And the only way to cure liver cancer is to mechanically remove all of the cancer out of the liver. Now, I use the term mechanically remove because there are several different ways that we can do this. The gold standard is surgery. So whenever we evaluate somebody who has HCC, we first ask, can we take all of the cancer out of the liver surgically? Now, one of the underlying problems for people with liver cancer, as opposed to people who have, say, colon cancer that spreads to the liver, is that the underlying liver is often not functioning well. And so it can be quite dangerous sometimes to take out the right lobe of the liver in somebody who has mild cirrhosis. And the liver surgeons become technically challenged by the amount of liver that they're leaving behind, the amount of functional liver that they're leaving behind. And so if a surgeon says, I can't cut this out safely, we then do consider whether somebody might be a candidate for liver transplantation, where we actually take out the liver and put in the liver from somebody else. And that liver transplantation evaluation is often done by a team of doctors at a major medical center, including gastroenterologists, surgeons, social workers, and a whole team of people who are looking at doing a transplantation. One of the problems with transplantation is that there's a short supply of livers, and so people have to wait to get a liver transplantation sometimes, and then we do certain procedures to try and keep the cancer under control until a transplant liver becomes available. Now, if a surgeon says they can't cut it out and a transplant team says that they can't offer transplantation, then we can't cure the patient for the most part. Occasionally, we will try mechanical means of removing the tumor, something like radioembolization or radiofrequency ablation. Radiofrequency ablation is when interventional radiologists typically will have a catheter that will heat up a zone of area around the tumor and try and kill all the cancer cells without taking them out. Cryoablation does a very similar thing, not with heat, but with cold, with freezing the cells around the tumor that are cancerous and trying to mechanically remove the cancer cells that way, so to speak. But for the most part, if a surgeon can't cut out a hepatocellular carcinoma and a patient is not a candidate for liver transplantation, then we don't have means to cure patients, but we have means to help them do as well as they can for as long as they can, to help them live longer and feel better. And what we apply in that situation depends upon whether the cancer remains in the liver or has spread beyond the liver to other sites, such as the lymph nodes, someplace else in the abdomen, the lungs. If the cancer remains in the liver, we'll often use what we refer to as liver-directed therapy. And they come under many different headings, but the main heading is liver-directed therapy. For instance, sometimes we do something called transarterial chemoembolization, or TACE, T-A-C-E for short. That is when a catheter is threaded up into the hepatic artery and substances, including chemotherapy, are injected actually directly into the liver with the design of controlling the cancer and even killing the cancer cells at that point. Unfortunately, these kinds of procedures rarely eliminate all the cancer cells, and that's why they're not curative. The other kind of approach that's gaining favor recently is targeted radiation to the liver. There are now newer radiation techniques that allow the radiation oncologist to spare the surrounding liver without the cancer cells and focus their radiation directly on the tumor. These are also ways that are gaining acceptance as to managing a patient's cancer that is isolated to the liver, meaning it has not yet spread beyond the site of the liver. So these are two examples of liver-directed therapy. And of course, the other mechanical means, particularly radiofrequency ablation, or RFA for short, is also used for patients who have cancer of the liver, HCC, that is not spread beyond the liver and not surgically resectable, and the patient is not a transplant candidate. So these methods have been associated with helping people do better with liver cancer and controlling the cancer for as long as we possibly can. Unfortunately, sometimes these cancers spread beyond the liver and they go to other sites and they metastasize, just like a colon cancer would metastasize or a breast cancer would metastasize and spread to other lymph nodes or other places in the abdomen or other places in the lungs, sometimes even to the bone. When that happens, we often turn away from liver-directed therapy and focus more on systemic therapy. And what we mean by systemic therapy is treatment that goes throughout the whole body, typically traveling through the blood system to be delivered by the blood system to wherever the cancer cells might reside in a person. There are two accepted forms of systemic therapy. There's a new targeted agent for hepatocellular carcinoma called sorafenib, which is a pill and targets a pathway called VEGF or VEGF, among others, and is helpful in controlling that hepatocellular cancer wherever it may be. It often doesn't shrink the tumor down so much, but it controls it, and as long as the cancer remains under control and can't grow in the presence of that drug, people do okay. The second type of systemic therapy that is used for the treatment of hepatocellular carcinoma is standard chemotherapy. So chemotherapy that is like chemotherapy for any other cancer that is typically administered intravenously, but sometimes orally. It targets the ability of tumor cells to divide and tries to slow down the cancer in that way. And again, as long as people have tumors that can't grow in the presence of the chemotherapy, they're going to be okay. And the chemotherapy drugs that we often will use in patients or for patients with HCC are drugs like 5-FU and oxaliplatin. That is becoming a very common regimen for people with HCC that has spread beyond the liver. The so-called FOLFOX regimen that is very familiar to patients with other GI gastrointestinal cancers. The other type of drug that is often used is an older drug called adriamycin, or variants of that particular drug. Adriamycin has been around for a long time and can occasionally keep these cancers under control for long periods of time. So, in summary, the first thing we do when we meet somebody with HCC is look to cure them, and we look to cure them by surgically removing the cancer. If we can't surgically remove the cancer for technical reasons, we often consider somebody for liver transplantation. If we can't surgically remove the cancer or offer liver transplantation, then typically we can't cure somebody with liver cancer. In that situation, we evaluate the patient for liver-directed therapies, and if the patient is either not a good candidate for liver-directed therapies, or the liver-directed therapies stop working, or the tumor spreads beyond the liver, we then consider administration of systemic chemotherapy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ryan. A very informative and really excellent presentation. Thank you. Our next speaker is Dr. Huda Pat. Dr. Pat is Professor of Medicine, Chief of GI Oncology Research, University of New Mexico Cancer Center, And Dr. Pat is going to present information about the bile duct cancer, an overview of bile duct cancer, the role of clinical trials, how research contributes to treatment options, controlling symptoms and pain, and quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure to turn the program over to Dr. Pat.
Thank you very much, Carolyn, and thank you, Dr. Ryan, for your covering the hepatoma, or the HCC subject. Now, as Dr. Ryan initially described, the issues in hepatocellular carcinoma management relate to the underlying liver cirrhosis, which really imposes limits to what can or cannot be done. Similarly, when patients present with a primary bile duct cancer, the issues that compromise our ability to treat are the result of the obstructive jaundice or the yellow jaundice that patients have due to obstructions in the bile duct. But when one talks about bile duct cancer, we are talking about a cancer that arises in the cells that line the biliary tree itself. That includes the bile ducts that are inside the liver, the larger ones that form the what we call intrahepatic bile ducts, then those intrahepatic bile ducts combine together, or they become confluent, and they form a bile duct that is outside the liver on its way to delivering bile products to the intestine itself. On the way, there is a gallbladder that stores excess bile that was produced and may inject it by contraction whenever some excess is needed. But a lot of patients do develop some stones in the bile duct, and a chronic infection of the gallbladder due to stones may eventually lead also to a primary gallbladder cancer. In recent years, there has been a decrease in the incidence of gallbladder cancer because so many people undergo laparoscopic cholecystectomy, that is, removal of the gallbladder if there are recurrent infections. And if there are no recurrent infections there, development of cancer can be prevented. The cells that line the bile duct are similar in a way to the cells that line the pancreas also. The diagnosis is frequently made when a patient comes in with jaundice that is yellow jaundice from an unknown cause, and you start by looking obviously at the chemistries, but you look at the CT scan and you try to see whether there is any cancer that originated, let's say, in the pancreas causing an obstruction of the bile duct. And if you don't see anything in the pancreas and you don't see metastasis, that is secondary spread from another cancer in the gastrointestinal tract to the liver, yet the patient is jaundiced, you may see a dilatation of the bile duct on the CT scan. So then we start looking for what causes that obstruction. the fancy name for a cancer that arises at the confluence of the two bile ducts is a cholangiocarcinoma or Klatskin tumor. That is after the name of the person that described it from New York. And the solution in order to be able to treat the patient is to open up the obstruction of the bile duct. It's quite possible that the offending or the cancer that has obstructed the confluence of the two bile ducts may be a very small tumor that you will not even be able to see on a CAT scan, yet it causes the obstruction because it is confined within the inside or the lumen of the bile duct that maybe are less than an inch in diameter when they are dilated, and when they are normal size, there would be only about 2/8 of an inch in their diameter. But when they are obstructed, either by a stone or by cancer, then they would be a lot bigger, and eventually no bile will get to the intestine. The patient will develop jaundice. He or she may have itching due to the bile depositing in the skin. The stool would have no normal color, but would be chalk-like. So the secret to treating the cancers of the bile duct successfully is to decompress, we call it, that is to open up the obstruction in fashions that could be even similar to where the plumber opens up an obstruction in the drainage system in your clogged sink, for instance. So the the entire treatment of patients with primary cancers, including hepatoma, but cancers of the bile duct, requires what we call a multidisciplinary approach. That is an approach by a radiologist, an oncologist, and most importantly, a gastroenterologist that can thread up that tube, like roto-rootering almost, the obstruction in the bile duct, and then putting in a stent to allow bile to drain out. And once it drains out and the jaundice resolves, the patient feels better. There are obviously always risks of infection, but those infections would be due to a foreign body that is located, that you had to place inside the bile duct. Once you have successfully managed the drainage of the bile duct, you can now consider treatment for the cancer itself. Now, not infrequently, the cancer can go from the bile duct, either from those inside the liver or outside the liver, and form masses inside the liver itself. And then when you see those, you can try and start some chemotherapy, which would help reduce the size and even reduce the size of the cancer inside the bile duct. Nowadays, at least one of the regimens that we know that has activity is a combination of a chemotherapy called GemZAR, or gemcitabine. It's a drug that had previously been approved initially for pancreatic cancer, and now it is approved also for the treatment of bile duct cancer, as well as for lung cancer and various other cancers. In combination with another agent called cisplatinum, it is associated with marked improvement, almost doubling of the longevity of patients so treated. However, in order to treat the patient adequately, you have to resolve, first of all, the jaundice. The objective of the newer treatment, that is identification of and of the clinical trial, is to identify what new approaches can be added to what we have today or replace what we have today. Since we know that despite the advances that we have had, we have not solved the issue of neither of liver, of the hepatoma, HCC, nor of biliary tree cancer. So we are having, for instance, a trial combining the combination of GEMSAR or gemcitabine and cisplatinum with one of the targeted agents that is directed against epidermal growth factor. It's one of the small pills called small molecules, and that one is called Tarceva or Erlotinib. The results have been recently presented, and it needs to undergo phase three trials to see whether indeed the addition of targeted agents adds anything to the treatment with the conventional chemotherapy that I have mentioned. The second, in terms of treatments, where does one go in the treatment of hepatoma and research, most of the efforts are being made in terms of systemic therapy in identifying new genetic defect that can be corrected or molecular or receptors. So the sorafenib was one of those. There were trials trying to look at a combination of Avastin, that is against VEGF, combining it with the Tarceva that I've previously mentioned, and combining it with maybe chemotherapies, but the limitation to chemotherapy that can be used in patients with liver, primary liver cancer or hepatoma, are the effects of the cirrhosis and what we call portal hypertension that causes low platelet counts and limits the ability to freely use chemotherapy that decreases blood counts. In terms of management of or symptom relief, the most important symptoms that patients with liver cirrhosis, as well as those with hepatocellular carcinoma that has developed in patients with liver cirrhosis, face are the fluid accumulation due to portal hypertension, and that requires judicious management of a fluid, trying to drive out some of the fluid. The problem is that most of the fluid that the patients accumulate is in the tummy or in their legs rather than inside their veins. And that is because the liver doesn't produce enough protein to keep the fluid inside the veins. So it requires a multidisciplinary approach to cover and manage the symptoms of the cirrhosis and the pain associated, provided you can use medications that would not compromise the patient's ability to think and to function. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Pat, for such a wonderful presentation, so informative and very helpful to the audience. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Ms. Dexaben Ammon. She's a senior clinical dietitian at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Ammon is going to address nutritional concerns and tips.
Nutritional goals for liver cancer are to prevent or reverse poor nutrition in order to maintain scheduled cancer treatment, to manage symptoms and side effects that can occur from the cancer itself, as well as cancer-related treatments, and to maximize quality of life. General nutrition recommendations for liver cancer are: eat small but frequent meals throughout the day. Try to eat every 2 to 3 hours to equal 6 to 8 smaller meals per day. This will provide your body with small bits of energy throughout the day. Try to plan meals and snacks the day before if possible. For example, if you know that you will be away from home most of the day, either for the treatment or for the doctor's appointment, make sure to pack calorie and protein-dense snacks to bring with you, like example, peanut butter and crackers or a protein bar. Drink plenty of fluids. A general rule of thumb is 8 to 10, 8 ounces of cups of fluid per day. Consume adequate amounts of protein like beans, peas, poultry, meat, and dairy products. Choose nutrient-dense foods like fruits, vegetables, and whole grains, and stay as active as you can. Unintentional weight loss is a common issue for people who have liver cancer. Weight loss is usually caused by an inadequate caloric intake, which is likely caused by various symptoms of the cancer and or side effects of the treatment. Treating the cause will usually help to increase calorie intake and stop the weight loss. Some common symptoms and side effects are poor appetite and early satiety, nausea and vomiting, diarrhea, ascites, and encephalopathy. If you are experiencing poor appetite and early satiety, which means getting full quickly, then consume small but frequent meals throughout the day. Avoid overly sweet foods or liquids, as well as greasy, fried, or highly spiced foods. Maintain good oral care and use liquid meal replacements like smoothies or supplemental drinks as a small meal. If you are experiencing nausea with or without vomiting, eliminate offending odors. Try room temperature or cooler foods because they tend to give off fewer odors. Drink liquids in the cup with a lid. Try dry crackers or toast. Try sour or tart flavors. Use anti-nausea medications as prescribed by your doctor to adequately control the nausea. If you are experiencing diarrhea, limit or avoid the following: lactose, but yogurt and buttermilk are okay. Insoluble fiber like wheat bran and whole grain products. Foods sweetened with sugar alcohol and sugar-sweetened beverages. If you are experiencing diarrhea, increase the following, like foods with live active culture, example yogurts. Soluble fiber like oats. High potassium and sodium foods or beverages to replace the loss of electrolytes if you are vomiting. And extra fluids in general to replace the losses. If you are experiencing ascites, which means retaining of the fluid in the abdomen, then consume small frequent meals throughout the day and decrease the sodium in your diet to help decrease fluid retention. If you are experiencing encephalopathy, which is impaired brain function due to the liver's inability to detoxify the body, this is usually treated with the medication. Know that protein balance is important for maintaining lean body mass. So, consume adequate amounts of protein daily, spreading the amount of protein consumed evenly throughout the day. At last, I would like to talk briefly about guidelines for supplementation. You want to avoid mega doses of vitamins and minerals. A daily standard over-the-counter multivitamin and mineral supplement, as well as calcium and vitamin D supplement, are okay. And finally, correct vitamin and mineral deficiencies under the care of doctor and or dietitian. Know that you can always meet with a dietitian for more personalized information as well. Thank you for allowing me to be a part of this teleconference, and I will now pass the line back to Caroline.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Ammon, for just a wonderful presentation, wonderful tips for everybody, which is so helpful. And our next speaker is Ms. Elizabeth Ezra. And Ms. Ezra is an oncology social worker. She's program coordinator at Cancer Care, and she's going to address the free psychosocial services offered by Cancer Care. Ms. Ezra?
Thank you, Carolyn. I am an oncology social worker, and I work with many people with primary liver cancer and their loved ones. I would like to begin by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with cancer and how Cancer Care can be a part of that network. There are many ways we can help. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Cancer Care programs including individual counseling, support groups, either over the telephone or online, education about resources and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance are provided by licensed master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. They are also trained to help cancer patients and their families tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, the physical changes, social adjustment, and psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. Cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through similar situations and have similar problems. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Support groups are a safe place where you can voice your concerns and your fears. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and the treatment. At this time, Cancer Care offers a general patient cancer support group over the phone, as well as online groups for caregivers, as well as a young adult caregiver group. We also have an online group for women with cancer. If you are interested in any of the Cancer Care services, please call our Hope line at 1-800-813-4673 or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive and you can find a lot of additional information there on your cancer diagnosis and the treatment you need to receive. Please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care services are there to help you. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today.
Well, thank you very much, Liz. Excellent presentation, and for actually helping people to understand all the services that they can access from Cancer Care. Now, we do have time for questions. We have actually a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Trinitha to bring all of our speakers on board. And let's take as many questions as we can. And Trinitha will explain to you how to queue up for questions. And we'll take as many of your questions as we can. Trinitha?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone. If you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. Again, to ask a question, please press star, then 1 on your touch-tone telephone.
So we do have a question from one of our online participants, which it would be helpful to address this. I know this was touched on earlier, but the question is, in addition to primary liver cancer, patients with colorectal cancer often develop metastatic tumors on the liver. Are the treatment options for the two types of liver cancers, liver tumors, similar or different? And this is a frequent question that people ask, and I'm wondering if, Dr. Pat, if you could address that.
Yeah. Thank you for that question, and it's an important one. The most common cancer that one finds in the liver is indeed the metastatic cancer from other sites, such as the colon, the stomach, but most frequently the colon, as it is a common cancer, as well as breast cancer. The treatment of the liver metastasis depends totally on the algorithm, actually. How you treat it is according to the regimen that you would use for the primary cancer. So colon cancer would be treated primarily with systemic chemotherapy that would almost always include a combination of chemotherapy combined with such as 5-FU, leucovorin, and oxaliplatin, or another agent that is commonly used, irinotecan, and that is combined either with Avastin or bevacizumab, which is an inhibitor of the monoclonal antibody against a stimulant of the blood flow and the blood vessels that the cancer tries to stimulate in order to grow faster and stronger, anchor itself in the liver or in other places. Or if the patient's cancer has a non-mutated gene specifically called KRAS, then we can consider another monoclonal antibody that blocks the receptor for epidermal growth factor. However, what is unique for metastatic disease from the colon is that you always consider the possibility of surgical removal of the metastatic disease if feasible and if the disease is limited to only one or two or even three, but if all those are in one lobe of the liver and you can cut out that lobe of the liver, you would almost always do it in combination with chemotherapy, either before chemotherapy and the targeted agents that I mentioned, either before the surgery or after the surgery, or both. You would try to limit the surgical interventions to those patients with a few metastatic lesions to the liver. It's important to always make sure that if you see in a cancer masses in the liver, you know whether those originated outside the liver or inside the liver. So if they originated inside the liver, or as we said, the bile duct, then that was the talk that Dr. Ryan and myself covered. If they originated in an organ that is outside the liver and the bile duct, then, again, the surgical options combined with a specific therapy that is specific for that cancer according to its nature. Thank you.
Thank you. Excellent. And there's another really important question that is coming from one of our online participants as well, in terms of the whether indeed this type of cancer has any genetic or hereditary link. Dr. Ryan and Dr. Pat, do you both want to address that?
Sure. So hepatocellular carcinoma, generally, we don't think of a genetic link because most of the hepatocellular carcinomas are caused by chronic liver injury from hepatitis or alcohol. Occasionally, people will inherit metabolic errors. One of the most common that can lead to chronic liver injury is disorders of iron metabolism. And those can run in families and lead to hepatocellular carcinoma. In terms of bile duct cancer, yes, it is in the list of inherited problems, although it's one of the rarer ones. But we do think of things like Lynch syndrome from time to time in people with biliary or upper GI tract cancers. Lynch syndrome is the common type of inherited cancer that people get, typically colon cancer, but occasionally upper GI tract cancers can run in the Lynch syndrome families.
Sounds like Dr. Pat, did you want to add anything? Or?
Well, I think that Dr. Ryan covered it. The most important, by the way, in addition to the role of infections in hepatocellular carcinoma, we are seeing now that patients that are hepatitis C virus infected and have liver cirrhosis have a somewhat increased risk of developing the cholangiocarcinoma, that is primary bile duct cancer as well, that is usually the intra or extra hepatic. I'm not talking about the gallbladder cancer. To a lesser extent than in hepatocellular carcinoma, a much lesser extent, there is an association between bile duct cancer and liver cirrhosis as well.
Now we have another question from one of our online participants. Does everyone with hepatitis C eventually develop liver cancer? And contingent on that is, should everyone with hepatitis C get ultrasound screenings?
Well, let me take this one.
Okay.
Everyone with liver cirrhosis due to hepatitis C virus, if they have advancing liver cirrhosis, they really require the surveillance because the risk of eventually developing a primary hepatocellular carcinoma is quite significant. It's almost 2 per 100 per year or 1 per 100 per year. So it's an incidence that justifies the surveillance. But if patients do not have liver cirrhosis and have hepatitis C, then the risk is not there as yet, but the risk of developing the cirrhosis is, of course, persistent. Now, it's important to realize that nowadays we have newer treatments that can eliminate from the blood the hepatitis C virus, even in those patients that have a genotype that's called genotype 1, which is the most resistant one to, had been the most resistant one to previous therapy. And nowadays, with the addition of the protease inhibitors, these are drugs similar to what had been used in HIV infection, you can cure hepatitis C chronic infection, but that requires a treatment with the three agents, namely interferon, ribavirin, and the third one, which is the protease inhibitors. And it's expected within the next couple of 3 years, we will see elimination of HCV, that is hepatitis C virus, from the blood in a similar fashion to what you saw with HIV, what we have been seeing with HIV.
So this is really a major development then in this field.
Yes, in the treatment of hepatitis C. Now, it doesn't mean that eliminates the risk of liver cancer, but the if you eliminate the infection, the risk will eventually decrease. And a similar thing has happened actually with hepatitis B virus. Now that we have almost universal, in the United States it's universal, but it's important even, for instance, in Taiwan, now in China, in Singapore, in countries where you had a high incidence of hepatitis C viral infection, hepatitis B viral infection, the ability to vaccinate universally and especially to treat newborn children born to mothers that are hepatitis B infected with the vaccination along with hepatitis B immune globulin, there has been a major decrease in the incidence of chronic liver disease, liver cirrhosis, and liver cancer in young people in the Far East, in countries like Hong Kong, Korea, Taiwan, China, etc.
This is exceptional. Thank you. This is extraordinary. Thank you. And I want to thank all of our speakers. You've really been extraordinary today. This has been an amazing call. I want to thank you both for your amazing information, but also for your compassion on the call today. And I want to thank all of you who've asked questions online. A lot of you have done of using the online feature here and asked such really good questions. And I also want to thank all of you who've been listening. I want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour program and that in planning a workshop like this, we are very much aware of the fact that you have many issues and questions that go far beyond the scope of one-hour program. And so I do want to just briefly review with you many of the services that you can access from Cancer Care so that when you conclude the program today, you don't feel you're alone. And most importantly, as Liz had said, we don't want anyone to leave this call feeling that you're alone. We want you to know that you're part of this support community from Cancer Care and that we're here to help you. So we have a staff of over 40 master's level trained oncology social workers, and we're here to provide a host of services to you, from practical and financial assistance to counseling to support groups, and both support groups on the telephone and online. And we also have these workshops, and of course we have materials and fact sheets and brochures that you can access from us. So there is a great deal of help available for each of you on the call today. If you didn't get to ask your question today, please call our 800 number at 1-800-813-HOPE or visit our website at www.cancercare.org. And again, I want to thank you all for participating today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may disconnect and have a wonderful day.